Welcome back to another episode of Punches and Popcorn, the show where we dive into the best, the worst, the history, and the science of martial arts film. And we are in the final episode of our first season, Once Upon a Time in the 80s, talking about an immortal 80s movie. With me tonight are, of course, my co-host, Jason the Genius Bills.
Happy to be here for a solo podcast episode, just us hanging out talking about this movie.
Oh, yeah, crazy. And also, just us hanging out is our man, our professor, the walking weapon, Dr. Dominic DeMore.
Feel the stag, McCloud. Feel the stag. I am hoping all of us will be doing our best / worst Connery imitations today.
Spaniard.
I want to ask you about that accent, but I have a feeling that we're going to be talking a lot about accents tonight. And I'm hoping that maybe we'll get some more special accents when, surprise, we aren't alone. We are bringing in and partnering with our friends from the Anomaly Film Festival, the Anomaly Podcast, what we think of as the show that made us and created us and continues to inspire us. First, our returning member, Jason, is smitten with surprise here.
Yeah. What? What's going on, Mike? Explain yourself. Who are these people here?
They have come for the gathering, and we are going to end this season with the gathering with our friends from Anomaly. And
someone has to be beheaded. It's fair.
The return of our own Kurgan, the magic man, Matt Knotts.
I love that. I love being the Kurgan. Also, if we can make this a gathering much like the Juggalo gathering, I'd be really into that. I have just a shitload of Faygo here, and I'm ready to go.
All right, well, before we all exit the camera to go put on our face paint, we also have another one of our friends and superstars from the Anomaly Podcast. We have Meg.
Hello, it's too early for the gathering. I can't. The prize is not worth it. I'll just go back to bed. It's Saturday.
You get it.
I can't fight. Maybe fair tomorrow.
Enough. Fair enough. Yeah.
Tomorrow's a day of rest. That's Sunday. You can't do that either. That's
okay. Okay. We'll figure out sometime next week. Everyone, we'll get our calendars out. We'll use Google. We'll figure it out.
Someone's going to be Tuesday beheaded Tuesday? Next week.
Next week. Yeah. Pencil it in.
Yeah. Right. And I feel like I've been beheaded. I say tonight, but we're recording this in the morning. And I don't know about you, but it feels like it's 5 in the morning for me.
It's been that kind of day so far. It feels like very much a reverse Midas touch kind of day. So it's exciting to be here with you. Let's see what we can fuck up now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. So the movie tonight that we are talking about, or today or this morning, wherever we're going with this, is 1986's classic sword and sorcery film, Highlander. This film, which actually came about as a film school student's, I think, screenwriting project, and maybe Jay knows more about that, eventually became a film starring a man who did not speak English at the time, Christopher Lambert, who we have talked about before, and I'm excited to talk about more here, as the Scottish, again, presumably English-speaking hero. But more on that later. And, of course, the famous Clancy Brown as the Kurgan, who shares that title with our own magic man. Before we get started, I'm hoping that, Jason, you can get me a little sharper here with our own gospel, the gospel of the guillotine.
You got it, genius.
Genius.
I'm a genius.
He's geniusy.
Wile E. Coyote. Super genius.
Was it you, genius?
You little genius, you.
Being a genius certainly has its advantages.
All right, so I've been sort of blown away by Highlander content recently, basically because we're talking about this episode, but this thing is a juggernaut. There's been 5 movies, an anime, 140 hours of television, 20 hours of cartoons, a book series, a comic book series, as well as like conventions, merchandise. Like, this thing is insane. So I kind of wanted to quickly get us up to speed with Highlander because it sort of caught me off guard, because obviously I knew of the movie series vaguely. But there's a lot going on. So I'm going to table Highlander 1 since that's what we're all going to talk about today. We're going to jump to Highlander 2. So just to kind of set the table and get you all up to speed on Highlander, original came out in 86. In 91, there was a sequel subtitled The Quickening. What's weird about that is they sort of just kind of like, I guess in the first one, they wrote themselves in the corner. Spoiler alert, Connor becomes mortal. But in the second one, they're like, we need a sequel. So at some point in the movie, not only does Connor become immortal again, he uses his powers to bring back Ramirez, aka Sean Connery. It's like, is nuts. So they're just like, oh, remember that first movie? We're taking back everything. Fans hated this movie. Not only that, there was a Mr. Burns level style ozone machine where the villain of the machine, villain of the movie, had a global warming machine which blocked out the sun, which made everything darkness. And so that's sort of what they're fighting in the second movie. Like, it's insane. And not only that, like, again, as I told you, no one liked it. We find out the Highlanders are aliens from the planet Zeist. You can't, like, it's almost like a parody movie. We're going to talk about that, I think, as a podcast eventually. But anyways, we're going to skip ahead to just kind of streamline this. Also, side note or footnote, there's a great documentary in the Quickening Blu-ray about the production of this movie because weird things happen in Argentina, and it's called Seduced by Argentina. So anyways, long story short, check that out because everyone has the Highlander 2, the Quickening Blu-ray. So that was 91. Then in 94, the Highlander 3, The Final Dimension, or The Sorcerer came out. And what's cool about that is Mario Van Peebles is sort of like, they sort of retcon 2, like, hey, 2 didn't happen. No one liked that. So they basically redid the first movie, but with Mario Van Peebles as the Clancy Brown Kurgan role, which is kind of cool because nobody brings Peebles together like Mario Van Peebles. I just came up with that pun. While that's happening, though, everyone, the TV series spinoff happens, and we're introduced to Duncan MacLeod, Connor's cousin. And Connor trains him, obviously not in the show. And so Duncan's on these adventures happening from 1992 to 1998, 119 episodes, 6 seasons, like insane. And so much so that this was an international hit. Like Adrian Paul, the man who plays Duncan, sort of becomes a thing. Like literally last week, May 24th-ish, like 2024, he was at the Comic-Con in Baltics in Lithuania, and people were standing in line for Adrian Paul to get his autograph because that is how much people love the Highlander and love him as the Highlander. So the TV show even had a cultural footprint. That leads us to the year 2000, Highlander Endgame. Think of this as the Star Trek, Wars Trek in my brain, generations of the series, because Christopher Lambert, aka Connor from the movie we're going to talk about eventually some night, once I stop talking about it, I said night, I don't know why, he meets up with Duncan, his cousin from the TV series, and they gang up as a team to win the day. That is in 2000. Fast forward to 2007, when we get two Highlander movies, not one, but two. This one, Christopher Lambert is like, guys, I know I could make a paycheck. I'm tired. You do your sci-fi direct-to-TV movie. This is the first Highlander film not released in theaters. And so Adrian runs with this. This is so critically reviled that the producer calls it Duncan's bad dream. So not so good. The Highlander series, it's hampered a little bit. That same year, an anime spinoff comes out called The Search for Vengeance from the creators of Ninja Scroll and Vampire Hunter D. This is actually pretty cool. Like, Colin MacLeod, apparently we always had to be with the immortal MacLeods in this journey, but he meets up with Marcus Octavius, who is an actual Roman army general from like 125 AD, and they sort of had this back and forth, and their enemies. They eventually meet up in 2187 post-apocalyptic New York City to have their showdown. So, and I actually hear that one's pretty good, minus all the bad-mouthing of the first 3 sequels. So I kind of want to check out the anime. But while that's all happening, we got the TV show. There was an animated series from 1994 to 1996, 2 seasons, 40 episodes. It was like even us 90s kids, because that's what I was, I guess, at the time, were being targeted by Highlanders. There was a TV spinoff in 1998 called Highlander the Raven, aka Lady Highlander. It only lasted a season, 20 episodes. But again, they're just making Highlander a thing. I didn't know about it at the time. I still barely know about it. It was happening. There was a book series, a comic book series. So up until recently, 2017, there was a Highlander Comic-Con. Like, this is insane. Like, Terminator and Alien franchises, they're kind of phoning it in. The Highlander is what's happening. So much so that there's a Highlander reboot coming very soon, from what I've heard, from the John Wick director, Chad Stahelski, and starring Henry Cavill as our new Highlander. So, like, it's still happening. 1986 is when this started, and we're still dealing with the repercussions today.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. Well, I had to do that for you guys, so you knew what was up.
It's still happening. Oh, still happening. Yeah. Look around. Look out the window. There's a Highlander out there.
You're going to see so that. Oh,
yeah.
Well, that's the 80s. Like that's one of the things. It's funny how we've had a lot of discussion on this about, like, a 70s movie versus an 80s movie. I feel like... And George Lucas is the person to blame for this, by the way.
That's fair.
I feel like 80s movies planted world-building seeds. That's what they did. Like, I mean, think about it. How many movies, you take a premise, you plant the seed for the premise, and then you milk it for as much as you can. Think about 80, like, true. 80s movies in general. You have all of Star Wars. Star Trek comes back, right, which is another thing. You have movies like Gremlins. Like, Gremlins could have been wrung out. The idea, okay, you go at midnight, they turn into monsters, blah, 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 blah.
Thank God for Joe Dante.
Yeah. and then you got Highlander, and there's all these, like, here's a cool premise that's totally out there and leaves a lot of avenues for exploration. Let's go with it. And now 30 years later, we have the MCU and we have Star Wars and we have basically things that are just world building. So the fact that Highlander has been, like, kind of growing its tendrils into our culture since this movie came out is not surprising to me at all.
Yeah, that's fair.
You know what? It's interesting. I was aware of the TV show and some of the sequels, but I did not realize that the HCU reached that far. So,
well said, HCU. That's what's happening.
Amazing intro here, Jay. So I'm very interested from all of you whether you entered the HCU through this tendril of the film we're talking about tonight, this morning, wherever we're calling it. kind of as we usually start, what are your thoughts on this movie, or how did you come to it? I'll leave that, and you can kind of decide where you want to take your first slash at it.
Can I jump in real quick and just say,
please,
I would
do.
Argue that there should have been two more movies out of this movie before we got to Highlander 2. I told Meg before we got on, I felt like I spent my entire lifetime watching Highlander last night. Holy cow, this is five different movies, and it's so bloody long. Like, I went in and checked how long we were into the movie at least four different times, and every time I looked, there was 40 freaking minutes. I don't know how it happened. Like, how is this movie so interminable? It's enjoyable in parts. God bless you, Clancy Brown, like, MVP of the movie. It's Pillar to Post, one of the most improbable movies I've ever seen. And Jay, as you're going through the franchise and saying that there's been like 7,500 movies and 1,100 episodes of TV shows and 16 anime, I'm like,
facts.
I think I watched all of them last night. I'm pretty sure. I don't know if I enjoyed, didn't enjoy. I think I'm just overwhelmed.
That's fair.
You know what's amazing? Take everything Matt said for me, but in a complimentary tone. Everything he said is the reason I was just absolutely vibing with that film last night, because it had been too long since I revisited it. Because I'm of an age that I absolutely, like, saw this, like, not even paying attention on cable enough. Like is that one of those films that just got in there whether or not you were watching it?
Exactly.
So it had been a while since I just seen it, and I'm like, oh wow. Look, it's like there's like three movies in here, and it's all vibes. It's all vibes.
Vibes.
Like, this film is like, don't even like get too caught up in any one chunk, because we're gonna move somewhere else. It is both a gritty 80s neon rain like dystopia, but also it's a beautiful pastoral look at the Highlands in like the 1700s.
Yeah.
You know, and a couple little like, oh look, Revolutionary War. Oh look, like they got powdered wigs. It's so fun. Like just I like a movie that doesn't over-explain a thing. This movie is packed with shit that it will never explain to you, and I appreciate. I'm kind of depressed. Like, I understand why they made all the sequels and all this stuff because they packed so much in this film. They have to, but I don't want them to. I'm like, no. Like in 2 minutes, you understand the relationship between Connor and his adopted daughter Rachel. You see her, give you a little flashback, and you get it. And I'm like, that's great movie. Right. You trusted. No, either they trusted me or they ran out of time. I don't care. Right. It was great. I'm like, keep it. I can keep up, movie. Keep it coming.
Yeah, I'm more of a Meg than a Matt right now. I'm on board.
Ooh. Yeah.
Welcome. This is a nice side to be on.
Like I said, I didn't say I liked or disliked. I just felt like I was drinking out of Spanish Pinowski's hair hose.
There were some critical things that were said.
We know you're the Kurgan, okay? Like, listen, you have no connections in life anymore. You're just like mad and destructive. And as soon as you get the gift, you'll destroy the world. That's fine, Matt. We're all different people.
I mean, that does track, yes.
Yeah, Matt. Typically, I'm the critical one, but you're like, did I love it? Did I hate it? Like, oh,
it's even worse. I have no feelings.
it's a gentleman seven for me. Like, sure.
Damn! Just the movie.
Boo this man.
Tomato.
I really hope that as the Kurgan of this episode, that when we go for break and we come back, Matt has a hastily shaved head because that would complete the.
Or I have a whole box of safety pins here. Don't tempt me.
We'll come back. He'll be licking a priest's hand. I'm aware.
Yeah. Well,
I'm sorry, Matt. I feel like Anomaly should stick together, but I can't. I can't go down this road with you.
It's fine. This is why Anomaly is Anomaly. We don't always have to agree.
And this is why when we have gathered for the gathering, at least right now, we're going to say this is the gathering of Highlanders, Immortals. Like, did we ever get a title? Jay, in the entire, like, franchise, was there ever, like, a title for these people given that you know of? Or it's just Immortals?
Yeah, it seems to be that way. And it's weird because there's so many, like you almost need a vocabulary. Like, there's Quickenings, there's The Game. there's so many titles it's either Highlander or Immortals. Like, they don't really give you a cool name like that.
So as someone who's seasoned in X-Men comic books, I find the degree of terminology and windiness not terrible in this movie. Uh-huh. What's actually funny is I didn't watch this movie as a kid. I actually never heard of it as a kid. What really? Happened was, no, my freshman year of college, I had a friend named Alan who was like, we should watch Highlander. And I go, I don't know what that is. And he's like, oh my God. So I'm not kidding. This is 1999. Mm-hmm. We drank between the two of us an entire bottle of Goldschlager.
Oh my God.
This is and all.
This and is watched, the right way it was to watch right. The Highlander. It was right.
And watch the Highlander. And I thought this movie was in. Incredible. I don't know if it was good. I don't know anything from that moment, but it was incredible. But like I said, the premise, and that's why we're all here, is this idea of immortals fighting for a prize was so compelling that like everything else you just want to like. I mean, that's the way I feel about this movie. Like, they're like, they came up with this premise. They're like, okay, how are we going to make an excuse to have essentially sword fighting Mortal Kombat throughout time? No, I'm serious.
Right. Yeah, I'm serious.
And then everything else was clearly just put in post hoc. Like, and that's essentially the way the movie is. It's just all this post hoc stuff. They're like, okay, they're immortals, right? That's how they, so instead of them fighting all in one place all at one time, let's have them all living for a long time. All right. And then they can fight for a prize. And what can the prize be? Well, we kind of sort of don't really define it, but who cares? That's not really important, you know? And then there has to be one guy that if he wins, the world will be in trouble. Then we'll make him Clancy Brown. And then, so it seems like there was so much crap.
A plunge pin?
And then that's what happened in the second movie. They're like, wait, we still have more to explore. I'm not really sure. And then they screw it up, and then so on and so on and so forth. But like, that's this movie. They're like, here's a cool premise. And then, like, the lore fills in afterwards, which is definitely, like, a comic book way of doing things. Where you have an interesting idea, you draw on your audience, and then you fill in the other stuff later on. And it's very obvious, but, like, who cares? It's fun. It's such a fun movie.
Oh, yeah. Well, let me... So, I have quite the background with this movie.
This movie
is my dad's favorite movie. We watched this... a million times as a kid. Like, my dad has all the, or at least he did at one time, the TV show box set. I don't remember watching a single minute of the show. I'm sure that it was on, but my dad loves this movie. In fact, my youngest brother is named Connor because of this movie.
Shut up, Mike. Shut up.
I am not lying. So,
oh my God.
Yeah, so this is a really huge movie growing up
for your family, let alone you.
Yeah
Wow.
And so I've watched it countless times. You know, I well versed in it, many of this, but it was very interesting going back to it. I'll admit, Matt, I was kind of with you in that I was watching it and I'm like, you know, I gotta get up and go to the bathroom or something. I'm like, I gotta be like halfway through this. So I pause it and I'm like 32 minutes and it's 2 hours. Like, most of the movies we've covered this season are about a good 90 minutes, right? That's one of the things that I love about action movies is they usually know how to get in and get out in the 80s, right?
You know my complaint about movies that too long. So yeah, I hear you.
Like, so yeah, I'm excited to talk. And this movie has, you know, which I'm sure we'll get into more, like some of the things that I know my dad loves that just fed into, again, we talked about all the pieces of this movie, and I don't want to get into all those because I'm sure we'll talk about all of them. But the thing that I think brings this to our show and how it kind of fits with Punches and Popcorn as a martial arts show, I didn't initially think of this as a martial arts movie, but it does
I pushed it. I'm interrupting. Because I remember how this worked out. Because for those of you that are new to our podcast, when we started this, I felt like people were like, oh, we're just going to do like, you know, Shaw Brothers style stuff. And I'm like,
And by people, he means me.
Yeah. And I'm like, no, we're not, because... why can't we do 80s action movies? There's plenty of punching in that. There's lots of martial arts in those. And I'm like, what about Gun Fu? And I'm like, as long as there's punching and kicking, it counts. I mean, I pushed for this movie because kendo is a martial art and that's sword fighting. So I'm counting it. And we're putting it in here. As far as I'm concerned, the movie qualifies if there's any violence that is outside bombs or gun at the hip, like, then it counts as far as I'm.
Also,
it's all push for this. So if you're mad, then fine, go ahead.
it opens with the most American form of fighting style too, professional wrestling.
Exactly.
Ah, yes.
And that's another one of, as I've discussed before, that's another one of my dad's favorite things is wrestling. So I know that was one. Again, this movie starts with an incredible Queen soundtrack just blaring, and then professional wrestling, and these are like two of my dad's favorite things. So it was our, and then you get swords,
Mike. We need like your dad on this podcast. I begged for this before.
Someday we will. It's
call him right now.
It's funny. I found the wrestling. I thought we were critiquing the wrestling. Like, the first time I saw this movie. No, I'm serious. I thought they were critiquing this. Here's this guy sitting in the stands, sitting there, just watching all of these normies go bananas over like scripted fighting.
I like this.
And then here's a guy who's about to fight, have a life and death fight, with weapons for literally the fate of the Earth. Like, I feel like I found that to be a juxtaposition. You had this very staged, very kind of choreographed, quote, fake fighting. Uh-huh. And then you have this life or death thing. Because he's not enjoying this. He's not like, I'm a fighter. I like all kinds of fights. He's like, this is so, when am I going to meet this facile guy and lop off his head? You know,
In the script,
so I thought it was a critique of you know, our lust for fighting, you know.
In the script, it was supposed to be hockey because the hockey sticks were supposed to trigger his like old, you know, Scottish memory of sword fighting. But the NHL did not agree to, they're like, no, we're not, you can't do hockey here. I don't know why they couldn't just do like non-NHL hockey things, but they were like, okay, so we can't do hockey, so we're going to go with wrestling because it's trendy and it's the 1980s. So that's how we got wrestling.
Hockey didn't want to be associated with beheadings, but professional wrestling's like, absolutely. What if it was the beginning of the film?
Yeah, exactly. NHL said no. Yeah, Vern Gagne, however, picked up the phone and went, yeah, absolutely. AWA wrestling? Yeah.
You got it.
Right, cool. Right. Yeah, I love that. Again, that's what I read too. The NHL said it was too violent. I'm like, meanwhile, this was the NHL that was employing guys like Luke Robitaille and Rob Ray at the time. Interesting.
I mean, yeah, they didn't really, you'll notice they aren't really in the sport anymore. You don't see Chris Nylands that much anymore.
That's true.
Those guys are kind of gone by the wayside, unfortunately. But yeah,
sadly,
actually, this is one of my inaccuracies about the film. It really pushed me out of it because AWA wrestling was a Midwestern thing, like out of Minnesota. This was in Madison Square Garden.
Madison Square Garden, yes.
Yeah, no shot. AWA is wrestling Madison Square Garden. That's
I get this, man. I know exactly what happened. You clocked out like 5 minutes into the movie. You're like,
how is this not for the
junior's territory?
Yeah,
you're like, well, they're not taking this seriously. I'm leaving.
You tapped out in the first 5 minutes, Matt.
You really think Vince Jr. is going to let Greg Gagne in the ring at Madison Square Garden? You're out of your goddamn mind. No shot.
They have your specialized knowledge, Matt. It's hurting you. Hurting you.
Totally agree.
Well, this is a great point because I have many questions about the historical accuracy of much in this movie. But I think right now, we're primed and ready to get into the meat of it. Let's take a little break, step away for a moment, and then we'll come back and we'll feast on this saga that is just the first bite of the Highlander cinematic universe. So punches and popcorn and Anomaly together, we will be back.
There can only be one.
And we're back to another episode of Punches and Popcorn and Anomaly together. This is our, for those of you new to Punches and Popcorn, again, we are a show where we dive into the best, the worst, and the science of martial arts movies. And we are finishing, this is the last episode in our first season. So we've been around for a couple of years putting episodes. We started with our buddy Matt here. We like to say for our Anomaly fans with us here tonight. I mean, we were Anomaly fans too. We love Anomaly. We've gone to the film festival. And so Matt kind of branched out from that and helped us launch this. And Matt is part of our family, and we've also got, of course, with us the wonderful and talented Megan Murphy.
We love you too.
Yay!
I don't expect more enthusiasm from Matt unless it's a Brian Trenchard Smith movie. Then.
Oh wait, we talking Brian Trenchard Smith? Oh no, don't get me started, dude. Mute me, Matt. Mute me.
Meg and I will go all day. We can make this a Brian Trenchard Smith.
All day. I'll talk about Stunt Rock for 3 hours straight. Rock,
Dead End Drive-In.
Man. Oh,
yeah. All right, take it easy. I'm sorry. You're
yes,
you know, you said the word, man.
Bottle.
Matt introduced us to the world of Brian Trenchard Smith last year with The Man from Hong Kong, which is freaking awesome. If you haven't seen it, see it. Yeah.
And the good cinema Lord's work.
Yes, and if you have, go check out our. We had an episode before we started this season. Man from Hong Kong. It was great. Matt was with us, and we went to the Church of BTS, Brian Trenchard Smith, and it was great. But we are here to worship at the Church of the Highlander. We have a gathering of two podcasts to close out our first season. So we started getting in on this before the break. Let's jump in and battle it out to see who will emerge victorious. So again, we talked about this movie starts with a wrestling match that quickly devolves or evolves, depending on your perspective here, into a sword fight with a lot of backflips. So I'm just interested from all of you, you know, kind of mentioned sword fighting and wrestling. Good point, Dom, was kind of the gateway for us into coming into our martial arts show. So I'm
like
interested from you.
A couple tips from Jumpin' Jim Brunzel.
Yeah. So what did you guys think about the sword fighting, either here or in the other fights of the movie? Like, what did you think of the style?
I feel like, so
go ahead, Dom.
So to be, so I don't know a lot about sword fighting, but I feel like in the 80s, and this goes for even for before the 80s in Star Wars New Hope, I feel like sword fighting was a lot of just like hitting swords together a lot.
Yeah.
And like, I was looking at this and I'm like, I feel like back then that was good enough, but I feel like looking at it through modern eyes, I'm like, it's okay. What they did put a lot of effort into is making the sword fights feel magical. And I liked how, like,
yes,
when they'd hit a wall, something would explode.
Oh, yeah.
The car lights would turn on. And I feel like they put their energy less into choreographing the fights, which is kind of why we do the show, unfortunately, and more into the, like, more into the idea that these are not just humans. These guys are, you know, superhuman, and that I think makes up for it. So there's a there's pros and cons to the sword fights. The sword fighting, the like fluff, oh, is awesome. And when we bring up the fight between Ramirez and the Kurgan, I'm going to bring that up even more.
All right, excellent.
I like how location based the sword fighting is. Like every location is involved. Like they're thank God that parking garage is filled with giant land boats of cars so they can go pop on the hoods, but like they use that, or when he hides the sword up there. And then when we talk about the fight with Kurgan and Ramirez, then you've got crumbling like stones and stuff, and then you have one sword fight that just Connor getting stabbed repeatedly because he's drunk and not taking it seriously, which I think so each one kind of like had its own flavor, you know.
Yeah, and I love that you mentioned the hood rolling, because I'm just watching that scene and I'm like, I haven't seen this much hood rolling since the last Whitesnake video I watched.
He's really like, trying to contain it up
right
there.
Yeah, I'm like, where is she? Watch out for her. She's there somewhere. And I like, Dom, you brought up Star Wars, because I read somewhere that I think, Jay, if you know, feel free to correct me, but I think the fight coordinator for this was Darth Vader's body double, and I forget his name.
That is a deep cut.
So it did feel like that. Say a lot of the heavy, like broadsword kind of strikes. You know, and then something like, you're right, Dom, because that was always something. Not to like tangent too much into Star Wars, but when you look at like the prequels compared to the original trilogy, it's the a lot of those, the lightsaber battles look like this, where it's just heavy, clunky. And then in the prequels, apparently they're like flying magic ninjas because they're all over the place. So this is definitely
They basically took all the money from the plot and put it into the sword fights, which is why the prequels suck. And if you don't like me saying that, I'm still going to say that. They suck. Don't care. Because I feel like we're in an age now where the kids that grew up with the prequels are like,
love them.
They're good. They're nostalgia. Yeah. I'm like, they
people
suck.
Love
I don't
things.
Care how special they are. They suck. I hate them.
Careful. Oh, be careful, sir. I just quickly wanted to say the director, Russell McKay, he came from a music video background. So he was doing like music videos in the 80s, MTV Generation stuff, still like in its like prepubescent phase. He did Duran Duran. He did Elton John. Like he was sort of known for music videos. He had done one movie before this, an Aussie Ausploitation masterpiece from Australia called Razorback, which is really good. It's kind of like, think about it as like Jaws of Australia, but it's basically a pig just killing everyone. And the opening of that movie, just put Razorback on for the first 15 minutes and you'll have the best time of your life. It is so well done. He is like just all about like surreal visual approach, but with that MTV like editing generation thing, he's not concerned about realism. He's concerned, like, think about it almost like 80s Michael Bay. He's like, I need this to look cool, not real. And that is this whole thing. Like, does it look awesome? Yes. And then he's amazing. Done. And then
I'd like to comment on that, actually. So I noticed the lighting of this movie, like, it's very dramatic. Lots of blues. Oh, yeah. Lots of heavy blues. Also, cameras on strings. Cameras on strings or cameras floating. Like, this guy, I feel really bad he wasn't born 40 years later, because he would have made the best use of drones out of any director ever. No, seriously, even the first scene when they're in Madison Square Garden, did you notice how the camera literally flies?
It just flies. I was like, how did I all of a sudden, like, this is 80s. So how did he do this? How is this possible?
Cameras on strings. Like, he did cameras on strings before it was big. Like, the NFL didn't incorporate that in for another 30 years. Like, I thought that was impressive, and I love the final fight. I'm not going to spoiler it, but the final fight when they are fighting, you see the camera actually slide along with them, so it eventually overtakes them, and it's actually really cool because you get them from the back, and then from the middle, and then from the front, and then they actually pass it again. I thought it was wonderful. Like, the cinematography from this movie is
the transitions. I think that's
great. Yeah,
which makes sense now that you say he was a video director. That makes sense, like the vibesness of this, but also like the shattered glass transition, the one where it's like Connor's face and then it fades into like that public art on the wall. Had these like amazing, or when they go from the garage and they scan all of a sudden we're in the Highlands in 17, like,
that's actually like, Highlander transitions. Like, that's one of their signature touches.
Really?
And that is all the director, Russell McKay. Like, he is all about, like finding interesting ways to get from one scene to another. And I'd like to think that that was, like, an inspiration for Edgar Wright, like, because he's really good at that, too, mostly, I guess. Pilgrim. But, like, he definitely was a Highlander fan. But, Dom, just to quickly run back about your about the flying camera stuff. So that's a Skycam. Garrett Brown invented that. He's the guy that also invented the Steadicam. And so he's sort of like, he's like a magician of cameras. And so that is a tool he invented. And now, like you said, the NFL deploys it regularly every Sunday. But I guess they had to like restrict it on film sets because I guess there was some type of, I don't know why I'm laughing, but there was an accident where the camera might have maybe killed. I don't have the details, but like, so that's sort of been repressed from filmmaking, but the Skycam is a really cool thing. Like, is it dangerous? Sure. Maybe they have better safety protocol now versus 1980s, but
maybe
they were saying there's this really cool documentary on the making of Highlander where they have that zoom in with the Skycam on Christopher Lambert's face in the beginning, like during the wrestling match. And they had to like do all this safety stuff to make sure he didn't get killed from that camera rushing at his face. So
that's a good time to bring up. This is a good time to bring up that Christopher Lambert actually is almost blind. He's almost blind.
Really?
He's not blind.
Let's talk about.
I'm not making it up.
I mean, unless Google is lying to me, which is a chance. Like, listen, I didn't ask him. It's not like I met him and I'm like, bonjour. No, it's.
Bonjour.
but he can barely see without his glasses. Like, he's extremely myopic. Like,
really?
He has really, really, really bad nearsightedness.
Does he know about contact lenses, Dom?
LASIK. He cannot wear them. He cannot wear them. He cannot wear contact lenses.
He's too gorgeous. Is that the problem?
But no, no, I'm serious, though. Like, if you look, like, he has been injured on set a lot.
Really?
He can't see what he's doing. And he wants to do his own stunts. Yeah, I mean, let's talk about his past. Like, his claim to fame, a lot of people now don't realize, is a movie called Greystoke.
The Tarzan movie.
With that brow, he kind of like he's got such a prominent brow. He looks like an eagle. But also, I don't think he can see what he's doing. So he's always making this like, face. Like, you think it's intensity, but he just can't freaking see.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but I feel like during this whole movie, I'm thinking like Thomas Jane for some reason. And I'm like, if Thomas Jane did an Ancestry DNA test, he would come back 100% Christopher Lambert. Like, I don't know what it is. That's maybe a me issue, but I'm just like, it's Thomas Jane.
Oh, yeah. I could see if you told me they were related, I would believe that.
It was a Gremlin situation. Someone got Christopher Lambert wet. And Thomas Jane popped off his back.
Well, that person is a hero.
It was that rain. It was that scene at the end when like the water starts coming. That happened on set, everybody.
That was the I think that means that we can like include Thomas Jane's entire movie history within the Highlander cinematic universe.
So. Oh yeah, it's canon.
Throw it in.
There's 12 more movies amongst friends.
There you go.
Unfortunately,
after the Mist.
Immortal.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, after the Mist, his lineage is done.
Spoiler alert for the Mist, Dom.
We can cut that.
Nope. Oh, you spoiled it. You ruined people's movie lives.
Now it's just reversed. It's a feel good story of the year.
So, one of the things I read about Christopher Lambert was that he, prior to this, did not speak any English at all.
I believe that
his
gorilla was spot on in Greystoke, though.
Yeah, so he didn't speak any English, and he was charged with playing a Scottish character and adopting a Scottish accent. Let's talk about some accents here.
I refuse to believe there wasn't one Scotsman that could swing a sword.
Yeah. Why did they go to
1986?
I read somewhere that I think Mulcahy, he like looked at a magazine and saw like a picture from that Tarzan movie and was like, this is the guy. He's our guy. Someone said he only speaks French, he's like, it's okay. We'll figure it out.
It's okay. The Scotch accent is infamously easy to master for anyone.
Well, this is all a part of the vibes onlyness of his film. Yes. All you're looking for is the vibe of a tall Scottish dude, or the vibe of a Spanish dude who's also Egyptian. Like, it's funny, they didn't have a Scottish person on set.
With a better Scottish accent than the Scotsman.
But like the movie's like, don't worry about it. Yeah, I appreciate the movie's like, either come on the journey or don't, but this is where we're at.
Right.
Well, I don't think, I mean, the Frenchman thing is kind of weird, but I'm glad. So the stereotype of Scottish people in movies is they're all 6'7". They only eat meat. They love flashing their kilts. Like, I'm glad that you know, a Connor McLeod doesn't like fit that stereotype, and he looks like a normal size dude. No, I mean it. Like, he could have been a normal size Scottish dude. But seriously, all the stereotypical Scotsmen are like, I'm gonna pick a log up today for no fucking reason, you know. And I'm glad they made him kind of a normal guy. And
but he sounds like Werner Herzog from all of the movie. Like, that's what's taking me out.
That is a problem. So I don't have a problem with him sounding like that in New York.
Oh, you don't mind?
No,
that.
Seriously, hear me out. I don't have a problem with him having a weird accent in New York because he's 500 freaking years old. I've lived in Western New York for 10 years, and I'm starting to say water instead of water, which is kind of weird for me. So him living in America for 300 or 200 years, sorry, 200
that's
years.
Fair.
Might make his accent weird.
Yeah,
but he did.
But
there is that.
He should sound. But I expect him to sound like Groundskeeper Willie in the flashbacks, and that was a whole.
You're so right.
Well, and it's interesting that like there is that point early in the movie where I forget who says something about like maybe it's the Brenda that we'll, I'm sure, talk about here at some point, that she mentioned something like, oh, where's that accent from? And he's like, where are you from? And he's like, I've been from a lot of places. And I think to like Christopher's detriment, like Van Damme had not popped yet in America when this came out. So they didn't get that technique where they really mastered in Van Damme's movies, like shoehorning in early an excuse for why this character, no matter what their background is, has a very strong French
accent.
He's
from accent. Louisiana. It's fine. He's totally American. Yeah. Right. Don't even question it.
Meg's right. It's all about vibes. Vibes.
Instead of the old Schwarzenegger method of, yeah, no, his name is John Peterson, and he's from Detroit.
He's right, right, right. Soldier.
He's trying to get a present right. for his kid on Christmas.
Right. So we're kind of, you know, we're talking about after that initial fight, we get it kind of interspersed through the movie, but I think it makes sense to talk about it all at once. We get the backstory of Connor, right? And we see all those Scotland scenes. We're introduced to Ramirez, who will be his mentor, his Obi-Wan, per se, to use the Star Wars analogy, who is Egyptian, Spanish, Scottish, and he's also the chief metallurgist to the king. So I feel like I've only I feel like I've only ever heard the word metallurgist like maybe once in my life outside of this movie, but it does a lot of heavy lifting in this movie.
You're right, it does.
And this is kind of, so a couple questions here about Ramirez, and let's talk about like the history here. One, any clue, did kings have like any metallurgist, much less a chief one?
I thought when he said metallurgist, I thought he was like a fancy way of saying, I know blacksmithing.
Like, okay, all right.
Okay. Classy blacksmithing. So there's a lot, classy blacksmithing. So like, there's a ton of cultures where they like, they're not just making swords like bonk, bonk, bonk. Like they have fancy hilts and they're all folded a million times and bada, bada, bada. So there's probably in a lot of cultures or a lot of societies, like the best swordsmith. Uh-huh. And like that's probably what that meant, and he probably like hopscotched from Egypt to Spain to Japan to all these other places, and he's like, hey, I make these wicked swords, and that's how he did his thing. That was the impression that I got, is he's a swordsmith because it keeps him alive. It's kind of a good skill to know if you're one of those guys, I guess. So that's where I got it from, and I feel like he just use a big word for being I make good swords, and I go to people who also make good swords, which is where he got the super katana. That is a weird plot device. They're like, this katana was made with a technology that didn't exist until 200 years later. I'm like,
how did that happen? This is one of the vibes. But they, so again, historicity, he said that he's 2000 years old. That's part of his lore, right?
2,437 years old.
It's a Japanese sword that was made in 600 BC. So, but I looked at this, I was like, wow, were they making katanas back then? No, like at least what I saw. And again, this is using the authority of Wikipedia, so I'm not the professor here. It looked like, from what I could see, the katanas weren't made until like the year 700 AD or BCE.
Yeah, feudal Japan.
Right. I have an answer.
Were you there?
Okay.
Mike?
Yes, I want to hear.
Yeah. I have an answer. No, no. Here's the thing. Again, this is the movie not telling us everything, so I'll just fill it in myself, which I appreciate. Is it right?
Ooh.
No.
Okay. But, I like it.
Because here's the thing. I think the idea that Ramirez has traveled and he's makes swords, right? And we have the whole story that he got that katana because he fell in love with like this Japanese princess and her dad made it.
Yeah.
Maybe he taught. Like, maybe that reason that exists is because he's existed since Egyptian times. Any place he's visited, he might have spread, like, but only that spot. So, like, only, like, his one of his love's dad could make that sword because he taught him.
Okay.
Gotcha.
Like, I think it's supposed to be a symbol of him moving through history. Like, why does this weird anomaly exist? Because it's Ramirez.
Okay.
Yeah, that
all
makes
right.
a lot
like
of
it.
Sense. That makes a lot of sense. So
does
the technology.
Movie set up?
So I mean, we're not talking about like computers here. We're talking about sword making. So someone came up with this technology. It never caught on until later. So I think that's that's like essentially what you're saying. Yeah, and I think that's an interesting. And I think that's one of the things they were trying. I'm not sure how well they did it, but they were. They were trying to do the whole. This is where the Highlanders, I shouldn't call them Highlanders, the Immortals, play into history. So they do this like it's like the Forrest Gump thing, you know, how like
Forrest Gump,
they insert a fictional character into history and make him a catalyst for things.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they're trying to do that with this too, in a kind of half-ass way, in my opinion.
I mean, like the Kurgan.
The Kurgan. Let's talk about the Kurgan.
Let's talk about the Kurgan.
Kurgan, when they talk about the origin of the Kurgan, aside from the Kurgan himself, which is essentially, let's face it, he's Terminator from Terminator 1. He's gigantic. He's dressed like a punk. Yep. He's got long hair. He doesn't say a lot. He's just meaner than the Terminator, right? The Terminator doesn't care. But the character of the Kurgan, how they say he's from the Russian steppes, actually... There was so this is actually interesting. This is not my science.
Oh, okay.
I'm throwing it in now anyway. They refer to ancient cultures from about 4000 BC from the Russian steppes by the Caspian Sea as Kurgan cultures. What a Kurgan is it's a type of burial, a type of grave where they'd bury a person with all of his swords and his weapons and his shit. And then they'd put a mound of dirt over it, and that would be the burial site, and they called that a Kurgan. Now, I don't think they have any other artifacts of Kurgan cultures from that time. That's all they have. But they actually think that Kurgan culture was where most of the Indo-European languages came from. So he is as old as all the languages we speak now. Which I think is fascinating. It's kind of they added like a primitive element. So as far as like Indo-European humans are concerned, he's supposed to be like from the very beginning of that. But he's not a nice Kurgan culture. We don't know anything about Kurgan cultures. That's the mystery of it. But like they didn't just make up a cool word. If they did make up a cool word and call him the Kurgan, I thought it was just like an alien, like Mogjog, you know. But no, it's actually a thing. I think it was fascinating. Like, yeah, so he's actually from a Kurgan culture, which is older than all Western cultures.
That's great. Why only Clancy Brown could play him.
Yes. True. The famous Mr. Crab, Clancy Brown.
Mr. Krabs.
Amazing. Like, what a career. I love Clancy Brown so much.
I love him so much.
Because it's like all action films and amazing stuff. And then an entire generation that only knows him as Mr. Krabs. Mr. Krabs. And I love it so much.
Dude has been working for decades. I love him.
Right. I mean, I still think of him because it was one of the, aside from Highlander, one of the movies I grew up with was Animal House. So I think of him. Really? And thanks to the Twisted Sister video, right? That right, because he's the guy. I'm not like crazy that I'm, because his career is long, right? He's the jerk and the guy that was in there, right?
I'm gonna IMDb you to keep you on.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong, and that comes out later.
That was the other guy from Animal House, Mark something or other.
Oh, okay, all right, never mind. Well,
he's the head corrections officer in Shawshank.
That's what I'm thinking of.
He starts dominating in the 80s, Mike, not the 70s.
Starship Troopers. He's in Buckaroo Banzai as one of the more normal characters, which is nuts.
That's right. Jay, well, this is why you're the genius and I'm just the host. So
that's right.
Very all right. Well, I had him totally confused with somebody else, but still.
He's got a similar look to that guy from Animal House. He's just a bigger version of him.
I like you making me feel a little
better.
Don't
make excuses, Matt. Yeah,
but we did see him in John Wick 4.
Sure did.
It was 4, not
4.
3,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Mm-hmm. So he was already in 4.
He was missing a finger, if I recall.
That's right. So we've already celebrated Clancy Brown, and he deserves to be celebrated even more. So
he sure does.
Kurgan, I mean, talking about music videos, like how metal was his armor, that like skull armor, right?
He looked like he should have been in Danzig or the Misfits. It was perfect. Like,
and then I'm trying to figure out. So yeah, he had the same sword the whole time. At some point, did he have it converted to fit into?
I want
to
know.
Case, because he didn't need that when he's fighting Connor. Like, you could just have a sword. You didn't have to take it on a plane. But at some point. point. He had it converted because he has it like one of those put together guns, but it's a sword. Which
right,
is just
it's like
so
a sniper
cool.
rifle sword.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd like to think it's a new sword. I'd like to think after 400 or 500 years, he broke his old sword and he's like, I'm going to get one made of titanium.
But it has to look like this. It's got to be pointy and mean, and I can put my eyes between the pointy parts.
Yeah, he's like, he probably went to a metallurgist and like, I want to start. I want a sword that you make the space shuttles out of, and I want it to be collapsible with little flicky things in the hilt. And they were probably like, okay, you big scary man. And then afterwards, he's like, never speak to me again.
Yeah, Clancy like was sold on the script because it the Kurgan had like a pretty badass backstory. Like, again, I guess this is in because of my deep research. It's in the novelization of this movie is, and also in the, I guess the original script, like you said, Mike, earlier, from the UCLA student who wrote this movie while he was in college. Anyways, so his father kills him. He comes back to life because he's immortal, and he makes his father swallow a hot stone to kill him. Like, I just like, but like, there's just this really cool backstory about the Kurgan that I feel like
that's
totally
badass.
Gets set aside. And Clancy used to go to the scriptwriter. His name was Gregory Winden, and kind of complained to him because they kind of just make him into Freddy Krueger in this movie. And he totally seems to run with it, Clancy. Like, he's like, okay, this is what you want me to do. I'll do it. But he used to definitely go and vent to the writer of the film to be like, hey, listen, you wrote this cool script with this really cool character, and I'm just being Freddy Krueger now. And he used to listen to heavy metal like on his head, you know, in his like Sony headphones before the scene started. Everyone was scared of him on set, as you can imagine. They would just like keep their distance, be like, and he'd take his headphones off before they yelled, you know, action, and then he lick priest hands and
well, let's talk about
stylistically, I like how they differentiate. Connor wears the most boring stuff I've ever seen a protagonist wear in a movie. Like, it is, you have had hundreds of years and you have no riz. You have no style. Oh my god!
You don't like white high tops? Like, come on!
Kurgan's like, oh my god, '80s New York City punk. Finally, the style that fits me. And he just like he's living with the times.
He finds his home.
Where Connor looks like he's just going out to mow his lawn.
I mean, oh my god! I'm
to be fair, he looks like he is. We'll get to this here in a moment, but like in 1985, I mean, he looks like a guy who runs an antique shop. It's just more like he looks like a guy who runs an antique shop in like the Finger Lakes. It's like his pleated Dockers and New Balance shoes. But the one part I wanted to really hit on was what I think is Kurgan's most memorable moment is that we've hinted at a little bit here, the fight with Ramirez. What did you guys think of that thing?
I mean, that's awesome. It's what I like the most about that fight is the fact that for a second I thought like, wait, is Ramirez going to scare him away? Cause like first time I saw the movie, when he hacks at the Kurgan's throat and he cuts it a little bit, I'm like, Ramirez is going to live. Oh no, he's scaring the Kurgan away. He's clearly not going to kill him because we know the Kurgan's alive in the present. Or the 80s, but I was like, oh man, and then of course that's not the way it happened. But also they fight so hard they knock a building down, which I think reinforces the idea that these are superhumans. And I think that, like I said, and I like that also, freaking Kurgan's so cool. He's just snarling and slurping and drooling and flicking his tongue like Gene Simmons. He's like, like, it's just like, I love it. I love this guy. This guy is just gross and he's perfect. And also that's like, it adds to the stakes, because even though we're probably going to eventually get to what the quickening is, which we don't freaking know, but supposedly it's the prize is the power, but like supposedly if this asshole gets the power, we're gonna be thrust it into years of darkness or something like that, right? And I'm convinced that if this guy had like telepathy, he was like the Charles Xavier of our times, we would be in a lot of trouble. And like that's pretty compelling. You know, like he gives the movie stakes because the other characters don't. Like, he gives the movie stakes, and that scene really, really like shows you what a force he is. In the beginning, you're just like, okay, this guy's imposing, but I don't know anything out about him. Now I'm like, okay, this is what he can do. This is bad. Like, he's a bad dude.
He's a bad dude.
Yeah, he has to be one of the most menacing villains of the 80s.
I totally agree. Yeah,
and you're right, and that, and especially how it ends with the, what does he say to Heather, like, hello pretty or something. It's so that we'll talk about here when we get to the
have
end,
things but... to say.
Yes. Okay. Yeah
about that. Like, yeah.
You know, for some
yeah, go ahead.
I just, and I can't remember, were we ever told, like, why was Connor not there? And that he was just away. And then why did Kurgan not just? Because then we get this extended sequence where we see Heather and Connor's whole life together, and him having to lose her, and you know, the Oscar scene with the, you know, I'd stay with you forever and yada yada. Why didn't he just stay around and like wait? Like, why did he then decide, I'm gonna go around for another couple hundred years? This probably isn't a question that needs to be answered, but just like, why? He was already there.
The way I saw it is, once his wife dies, you know, now a couple things happen. One, he's never going to fall in love again.
Right.
Because he's so sad. He can never have kids, so he doesn't really care.
Right.
He knows about the gathering, so he'd better spend his time, you know, figuring out how to win that. Because here's the Kurgan, and that was the whole point of the movie.
I meant Kurgan. Like, he killed Ramirez. Why didn't he just stay there and kill and fight him? Like, now 100 years. Anyway, another thing. Well, let's go. So again, all this time passes, and we're into the 80s in New York City, which is a big wrestling faux pas. Sorry, Matt. I think Matt still looks really mad about that. but we're there, and we meet another metallurgist, Rachel. I don't know. I was thinking Brenda. I don't know where I came up with that.
That's Brenda, isn't it?
Brenda's the Rachel's
the daughter. Rachel's the daughter.
Right.
Yeah. Which I also have things to say.
Okay. Yeah, Which things do you want to say first?
This is all connected. If we're going to talk about the love story, which I think is the weakest part of this film, particularly the modern part, right? I buy like the historical one, because we are with them, right? And I love that. And just inside, like, we didn't need that final thing about Kurgan's all like, I had your lady. That adds nothing.
Right.
Yeah. Like,
it already happened. He killed Ramirez. Yeah. You're so I'm just like, for me, that's like that 80s movie thing where you didn't need it. So that's it.
Yeah.
And Heather won anyway, because she didn't say shit, which I kind of love. I think that's a badass move. She didn't talk about you at all. But anyway, so we have that, and I buy that. And I think that's very important to set up a man who does not want to have connections anymore. But I think the movie is, he still needs to have connections. But the connection he has in the present is not Brenda. I don't think there's ever a connection there. I don't buy it, not for a second. They're just jerks to each other until they have sex. But there is someone that he cares about, and it's Rachel.
Yeah.
The woman that we quickly set up is like, oh, she's like a secretary. And then we get a 2-minute flashback where we realize, oh, she was a little girl that he saved from World War II. And
from
has
Nazis.
Obviously. Yeah, Nazis, right? I think the movie has a little like fuck Nazis moment in there. I appreciate that. But, he takes her, right?
Right.
And at any point, he could have been like, okay, I saved you, and now you can get adopted or not. But no, obviously, they like he raised her as a daughter, and then obviously, he had to change until, you know, but he has kept her in his life. So, that's the connection. That's the thing that keeps him connected to humans, is Rachel, not Brenda. It should have been Rachel at the end. It should have been Rachel at the end, because that's why he wins. He wins because Kurgan has no reason to fight. He's gone mad with destruction. All he wants is chaos. Where Connor, as much as he tries to reject connection, as much as he knows it's pain, he can't. He can't do that, and he's connected, so he has a reason to fight. Anyway, should have been Rachel. I love Rachel. She's amazing. Yeah. Brenda is Brenda, and she has bangs.
To hopscotch off that, I think, first of all, I think you're 100% correct.
Thank you.
There's also several 80s tropes, which this whole season we've been talking about 80s tropes that you brought up. One, Nazis are bad guys. Like, yeah. They didn't need the Nazis in there, but, like, if you want to talk just about the quintessential in. 80s villain, yeah. It's Nazis. They're the bad guys. I feel like we should go back to that for some reason, but whatever.
Yeah.
Nazis are the bad guys. That's they threw fair. That in, right? Also, they threw in the whole, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you, I fuck you. You know, like, they do that in the 80s movies. Like they can't, there's never two people in an 80s movie that flirt like normal humans and then have sex. No, they hate each other and then they do it. It's just like, man. So
right.
You can't build anything off of that. Yeah.
Right, right. You know what? I love this, and I think we need to start a movement, Meg. Hashtag justice for Rachel.
Oh, my God. A whole movie with what was their life like?
Right,
anyway.
Right. Anyway, maybe that's in the HCU out there somewhere. So we do get... A lot of the, to me, a lot of the 80s scenes are fairly forgettable other than Kurgan going wild in a really fun hotel that he finds. And then it's just battles. And Brenda.
Oh, the car scene. We got to talk about the car scene where he kills, I forget his name, one of the immortals, gets the quickening.
Yes, because now we're in the gathering.
Rips the hood off the car. Throws the guy out, gets in, and looks at the woman, goes, "Mom," and then runs down the street with her falling out on the hood. I'm like, dude, that's awesome!
The best.
And he has, and it's a good foreshadow because then he has a great car scene when another 80s trope in a lot of the movies we've talked about this season is the girlfriend gets kidnapped, and in the climax, right? That's the stakes here, and he takes her on a nice wild ride. And again, these are like how many movies? What we've seen, like Kickboxer. Now, how many movies? And I can name one because my head is just on the finale here. But there's the rape is a device, and then. Just
unnecessary in Kickboxer too, I will argue, because he'd already injured his brother. Okay, I just feel like especially. Yes. Okay, I'm fine, but it's like unnecessary. Okay,
very.
Yeah, we've discussed that. We've discussed that several times in this show. How rape or sexual assault is used or attempted is used as a plot device, and it's been at least 1, 2, 3, like four. Is this a fourth movie?
Right, because like Police Story, they kind of joked about it. And...
Yeah, like 4 or 5 movies in this 10 movie season we've done has sexual assault been used as a plot device. So,
right.
And also like, and I've mentioned this before and I'll say it again, I want to watch these movies with my wife, who's not an 80s kid. And like, it takes her out of it because she's like, and I don't blame her. Like, I'm hoping that's, you know, there's no fun in that. Like,
But again, they bring us to this trope that we've seen again and again. That's probably is even older than the 80s. The love interest getting kidnapped and takes us to the final showdown between the two ostensibly remaining immortals. And we see who will be the one that remains. So the final fight, what did you guys feel a payoff from that? Was it as epic as you were hoping?
I like the animation at the end, and I like there was broken glass. I don't think it was the best fight in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it has fun setting, but like they don't actually hit, like Connor and Kurgan don't actually interact all that much.
Right.
We haven't really seen them interact until the end. So there's not that like I've known you for centuries, and once again we meet. It's like, hey, we're at the top of a building. Hey, do you think Madam Web ripped that off? Anyway, with a big neon sign. Anyway, I would want that to be true because it's hilarious.
Me too.
You know, I found that actually a more compelling scene as far as don't get me wrong, the action in that scene is great. The cinematography in that scene is awesome. The destruction of an iconic building was great. Like, I was like, you know, I feel like, and that's where, like I said, this movie excels not in the choreographed sword fighting, but in the collateral damage that's caused. Like, and I felt like that was the payoff in that scene, was all the blah, 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 all the stuff falling down and all the glass breaking. But I feel that the interaction between Connor and the Kurgan that has the most resonance is in the church, which we kind of skipped.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I forgot about that.
If it wasn't for that scene, the final fight would have been like, why are we here again? Okay. Mm.
Cool, right.
But that scene makes me go like, even before he kidnaps the girl, when he put, because remember, he lights the candle for his
Heather.
He lights the candle for her birthday, and then the curtain comes in and he puts all the candles out.
Right. Oh,
and
yeah.
He's just like sitting there. And that's where we find out about the rape. That's where it happened. Right. That's where he talks about it. And that scene, I remember in the church, and because I was like, because the first time I watched it, I was like, okay, this is going to be a filler scene. And I was like, no, this is a great scene. Like Clancy Brown kills it.
Oh, I didn't. Mm-hmm. Happy Halloween, ladies. Oh, my God. For no reason.
Better to burn out than fade away.
Right? Oh, yeah. He's eating in that scene. Oh, yeah. I love it. Yes. Yeah.
And I love that they got Highlander rules going on there where you can't fight on holy ground. So they can conversate, but they can't, you know, throw down.
Do you think that, is that just like a gentleman's agreement? Or is it like I want to know if they fight, well, like, those like ghosty things that show up at the end, like come in.
Yes.
I have a deeper question. Yes. Okay, so immortals have been around for a while, right? At what point is a religion accepted enough that it is a holy space? Christianity didn't exist when like Ramirez was first around. Like what becomes holy?
Well, do they have meetings? Holy ground?
Do they vote? Yeah.
I love
Scientology count.
Like, I hope that's the science segment, Dom.
I want to know, does like the location in Rochester that Matt and I have debated, discussed, where Metallica recorded Kill 'Em All, could that be considered holy ground? Could they not fight there?
I think if they didn't fight there, that would be betraying Metallica. Like, come on, it's
Dom has a good point.
Yeah.
Is there a rule that if it was a recording studio and then later sold muscles, can it be a holy?
Oh, can it lose its? It can be holy and then it loses it.
Oh, yeah. Who defines?
Yeah, like the Playhouse. Is that still a holy?
Oh yeah, it's playing
with tots in video games.
And now they sell tots in video games.
But
it's also part of the vibes only. Like, it's holy place because they need a scene where they talk and there's an explanation why they aren't just being I get it. Yeah. Like movie, I get it. And it's a cool scene.
Right. It's like the it's like the question that I always have with another 80s classic, Gremlins, is what defines after midnight? Because technically every hour is after midnight. But that's another one. All right. So I think kind of the last thing that happens in this movie that we've kind of like hinted at is the prize. And I guess we can throw in the quickening with it. What is the quickening and what the prize, I guess, is worldwide telepathy? And
I think the quickening is like hero orgasm. Like it's just
kind of, right?
It's a lot.
I like that they don't explain it. Like it's just like a cool effect and it's a thing that is cool. Like I think you can absolutely tell, and I'm sure all the extra content, you know, has explained it more. But one of the things I like about this is like it's just a thing. Don't worry about it. It's a thing. It's electricity. It starts cars. It's fine.
But it's funny, we talk about religion. It's almost proto-religious. It's almost like the real spiritual power. What I take from it is the Highlanders. I'm not a spiritual guy, but I'm just saying in this movie, the spiritual power that exists in the Highlander universe is nature. Normal humans don't have access to it, but the Highlanders or the immortals do. And they all have a piece of it, but when there's only one left, that individual gets all of it and has the ability to connect with the quote life energy of all living things.
Right.
That's why you can feel the shtag. Because even before he killed another immortal, he had the ability to connect with nature that normal mortals don't have.
It's like
if he's a good person, he can connect with nature and use it to enhance and create a better world. Whereas the Kurgan, if he connects with nature, he can cause wanton destruction. How they do that, like you say, who cares?
With one person. I like
that. So this is basically an earth-based force. It's the force.
Yeah.
Midichlorians.
all tying it together.
This is probably a great time, just getting into this expertise, to get to our science segment. And damn it, Dom, if your science segment explains to us that the quickening is tied to midichlorians in the air, I'm going to be real mad.
I'm going to be real happy. We did beheadings already.
With science!
Yes, science!
Science!
It's not rocket science! Just say yes and we'll move on!
Science! I don't think science knows, actually.
Blinded me! With science!
Okay, cool. So, we already did beheadings. I remember when I started the movie. I've seen this movie a couple times. Honestly, I did not need to rewatch it. I wanted my wife to rewatch it. She asked so many questions during the first 15 minutes. And in retrospect, I don't blame her. But anyway, so I'm like, I can't do beheading. What am I gonna do? And so, by the way, for our audience, if you'd like to hear my beheading science segment, that is Master of the Flying Guillotine. I talk about beheadings, I talk about what heads are, and I talk about things where you can cut off their heads and they don't die. Okay, cool. So let's talk about this. What's another aspect of this movie? Well, what about immortality? So I think we'll talk about the science of aging.
Ooh, okay.
What does it mean? I think it's something that, like, you think you get, but you don't. Okay. So first, let's talk about the ages of things. So things of different ages. So you think of a dog. Typically, a dog lives for a decade plus or minus, right? So you think about, like, a dog's live typically, the, you know, like a Burmese Mountain Dog dies at 8, whereas like a little dog can die at 14, right? Okay. But actually, there was a dog that lived to be 31. Cats typically live to be about, you know, what? Late teens, but there was a cat called Cream Puff that lived to be 38 years old. We have humans, typically human lifespan, and you don't die from something else. If you die of, quote, old age, you live to about averages like, what, 76, 78. But there was a person, Jean-Louise Clement, who lived to be 122 years old. And at present, there's a woman who's 117 years old, right?
So, but, question. Yeah. Here. Did the 117-year-old one get there by beheading the 120?
Yes, that's my second segment. We're done. Well, if we keep going, there are things that live longer than us. So, for example, there are whales. Plenty of whales that live over 100 years old. Tortoises can live between 165 and 255 years old.
Bastards.
Right?
Bastards.
There's a lizard-like organism that can grow to be 111 years old, right? Cockatoos that can live to be 120. The oldest vertebrate is the Greenland shark, and they believe they can live to be up to 512 years old. Right. There are clams that are over 500 years old.
Wow.
There are tube worms that they feel that are probably over 1,000 years old. There are corals that they have dated to be 2,000 to 4,000 years old. Trees, there are trees that are all kinds of ages. There are plenty of trees that are over 2,000 years. In fact, if you go to California, you can meet a bristlecone pine named Methuselah that is 4,855 years old, right? But that's nothing. The oldest animals on Earth are sponges, like glass sponges and stuff, to bring it back to Clancy Brown and SpongeBob. Glass sponges can be over 10,000 years old. So clearly age is very variable, so it brings up the question, what causes aging? We don't know for sure, but there's lots of cool ideas. So a lot of the ideas circulate around cellular degeneration. So like your mitochondria and your cells, they suffer dysfunction. So they don't process ATP. If you don't know what I'm talking about, don't worry about it, enough. And that causes aging. There's something called telomere erosion, which is where the ends of your chromosomes get clipped away, and that causes dysfunction. Stem cell exhaustion, meaning that stem cells don't replicate as much. Environmental factors, you know, like just life does it to you. DNA gets damaged and the cells don't do it. All kinds of things like that. So now that brings us to the next point. Why does aging occur? Is aging just an accumulation of this crap? So like things happen and eventually you die. So all of these things accumulate and you just kind of deteriorate. Mm-hmm. That was the initial thought, that aging is just something due to wear and tear of life and your cells just break down with time. Mm-hmm. But they don't think that's, there's another hypothesis that we age on purpose. That what happens is nature selects for you to stay alive and healthy until you pass reproduction age. And then it stops doing that. So if you notice that most of the aging effects that we have occur after prime breeding age, it's because nature has basically, okay, you've reproduced, nature selected for that. Now it's no big deal. So the idea is that evolution might select for you to age and die after you reproduce so the next generation can replace you. So age is kind of scheduled from an evolutionary standpoint.
Huh.
One of the things that... Jokes on you, nature. Jokes on you. No kids.
I was just going to say that, so I'm good. I can keep going.
You will never die.
Well, it's for the age of reproduction, not actually if. I can tell you, as someone who has two toddlers, I'm aging real fast. But just to hammer this idea home, there are organisms that essentially are immortal. And a lot of the organisms I mentioned that live to these old ages, they're not old, meaning that they don't look old. They look the same. So that Greenland shark that's 512 years old, it's just kind of the same. It's been the same. It just hasn't shown any deterioration. It's been exactly the same for all this time. A lot of turtles are like this. Sharks are like this. Clams are like all of the, a lot of these long-lived organisms. The reason they're so old is because their bodies aren't deteriorating slowly. They're just not deteriorating. They figured out ways to undo all those damages that happened to us.
Vampire sponges.
Yeah, the sponges. Like,
vampire sponges out there. Yeah.
Exactly. So they have stopped aging or senescence entirely in their body. That doesn't mean they're not going to die. They can be eaten, they can be squashed, whatever, but they will not die of old age because they will not age. They will not get older. They will get older, but their body won't deteriorate with age. So there are actually Highlander sponges out there.
And that's amazing.
When do you say you're going to fix this for us? Because I'm not doing well with the whole death thing.
you joke, but on a serious note, in 100 years or 200 years or some point in the future, I guarantee you they will figure out some way to undo a lot of those things I mentioned.
That does not help me, Dom. I need it sooner.
The world will be completely out of resources at that point, so it won't matter anyway.
Right, exactly. Right. Just in time for that sweet meteor of death. What I took out of that was that my children are killing me, and that sounds very accurate.
That sounds great, yeah.
Well, this is great, and again, I wish that our episode could be immortal, but alas, we must bring this episode to an end, and we must bring our first season, Once Upon a Time in the 80s, to an end. And I'm so glad that we had our anomaly friends with us. Matt, Meg, again, thank you for being here. Please, our listeners, can you guys just share what's ahead for Anomaly, and especially in our fair city?
Sure. You want me to jump in, Meg?
Yeah, go for it. You look focused and ready.
Yeah. So I think when this episode comes out, if you go to thelittle.org this coming Saturday, we've got a screening of Jurassic Park where you will see Meg and I, the entire Anomaly crew, as well as potentially most, if not all, of the Punches and Popcorn crew. Dr. Dom is going to come into town and regale us about facts about dinosaurs.
Yes.
It's going to be all decorated in the lobby. Mm-hmm. We've got Jurassic Park planned for Saturday Night Rewind. Check that out. AnomalyFilmFest.com for the festival. Passes will be on sale this week for November 6th through the 10th. Again, AnomalyFilmFest.com. You can pick up your passes at Jurassic Park. No, not at Jurassic Park. but they will be available to you online. Our passes are actually just now on sale a couple days ago. It's that whole like recording podcast
right.
release math thing that you have to do in your head.
Time travel. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's time travel and you always remember the podcasts are immortal too. Also, podcast news. We're going to get you on the comeback. Highlander 2 to Anomaly Presents with the Punches and Popcorn Boys.
Yes.
Coming to you in our feeds in the near future. So keep your eyes peeled for that. More Highlander goodness. We'll get KP in. She was bummed she couldn't be here for this one, but very excited to cover Highlander 2. I don't know that she's seen either of them, so it'll be interesting to see bringing her in on Highlander 2, how she feels about
that. Oh, that's going to be great.
So, KP, do not watch Highlander. Only watch Highlander 2 because I want to hear what the experience is.
Just go in completely blind to the first one.
All right. Well, excellent. A lot of exciting stuff ahead. You know, we always love our friends at Anomaly. Thank you for coming here. Please check out Anomaly online through the socials. If you're in the Rochester area, make sure you mark those dates in November for the next festival. We're always there. And if you aren't in Rochester, you should get here. It's a great excuse to come. And November's beautiful in Rochester. Trust me on that. And again, listen to our other fellow shows on the Lunchador Podcast Network, including Food About Town, Behind the Studio Door, Behind the Glass, the Level Up Podcast, the Pauly G Show, and many others. So again, check that out. We have, I believe it's at Lunchador Pod for most of the socials.
Yep, and lunchador.org for the website.
Yep, excellent. And we are at Punches and Popcorn on pretty much all the socials. You can find us there. So check it out. Again, this is the end of our first season, but we already have season 2 planned and working on it. So that'll be coming out this summer. So pay attention to our socials for more information on that and go and check out some of our older episodes if you haven't. So again, friends, this has been awesome. Thank you again.
Thanks again for having us.
Thank you. Absolutely. I cannot wait for the second gathering in Highlander 2.
Quickening.
All right. Well, everyone, remember, there can be only one. Good night or good morning.
Feel the
good
stack.
Day.
This has been a presentation of the Lunchador Podcast Network.